is Mike Webb, in Arkansas. And I can push the right-hand button to stop it. Push the right-hand button to stop. And it's off. Yes, it is. No, it is moving. Okay.
Welcome to the meeting of the Select Committee on Economic Development, and we just want to say, Minister, we want to wish you well over this in this holy month of Ramadan, and well for the fast. Now it's the battle getting up early, but I believe you are an early bird, so we wish you all the best and the strength for this month of Ramadan, inshallah. If the Honourable Lees and Van Lingen are having their conversation, must we wait for you guys? Can we proceed? Can we proceed? Must we wait?
I just asked you that was the signature, Honourable.
You can do that after the meeting with a cup of tea. Or some lunch. Thank you, Honourable Van Lingen. Honourable members, before Minister proceeds, or before we proceed with the program, I would just like those to have a cup of tea. We'll pause for 2 minutes just to get a cup of tea and something to eat, because I don't want any up and down or disturbance when Minister presenting his, the implementation and that, so we can give and we can listen attentively. So I think I will be very generous this morning and just give you 2 minutes to get your tea and sandwiches, and then we can proceed. Is that in order? Honourable Lees? Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. While the other members are also entering, we can quickly do that. Sorry, Minister, the tea was late this morning.
If
Are you done?
Can we settle down now? Copen, the DA can just settle down and I think we want to start. Leave that quoting for the marriages until outside the meeting. We will allow you time outside the meeting to do that quoting. Copen, the DA. For those that have joined us, welcome. Sorry that we have started before you have arrived. We really apologize. Next time we will check that you are for us so that we can start. But sorry to have started before you have arrived. Honorable members, officials of the department, honorable minister, thank you once again for availing yourself and your time. We know that you're quite busy, hectic schedule, but thank you very much for coming and do the presentation yourself. We really appreciate that as a committee, that you always have the time for the committee and always be available for the committee. It's really appreciated, Minister. Thank you very much. Also for the officials of the department, I'm going to ask the members to introduce themselves now and then the department, and then Minister can then take us through the presentation. My name is Freddy Adams. I'm a member of the committee of Select Committee on Economic Development, also which comprises mining and energy. I'm also the chairperson of the committee, and I'm from the Western Cape, permanent delegate from the Western Cape. I'll start on my left.
I'm Tumtani Kamete from KwaZulu-Natal.
And I'm Thomasan Lees from KwaZulu-Natal.
Good morning, I'm Elza Fenglingen from the Eastern Cape.
Morning, I'm Masipa Kodikhane from the Fobo Province.
Morning, Sherry Chen from Gauteng.
Bafuna Limgoli, Free State.
Kenneth Sinclair, Northern Cape.
Mark Curry from PNG.
Swazi Taitai from Economic Development.
Richard Levine from Economic Development.
I'm Tanya Faniela from Economic Development.
Ibrahim Patel, I think from Economic Development.
Hunter Patti, Economic Development.
Robert Shaw, Economic Development.
I'm Grace Nizulu, Committee Secretary.
I want to know who everybody is now. There was a gentleman that introduced himself as Richard Levine. He's the Director General of the Economic Development Department. He's the big boss there. So whenever we need someone to come and do to account, we can call on Mr. Levine and just Professor Levine in actual fact. And Mr. Lingen, you can fire at Professor Levine. And if there's anything that you don't see, just fire at Professor Levine. And then the gentleman with the red tie, that you think he's from Economic Development, he's Honorable Minister, and he's a very busy man, you know. And so we want to thank the Minister for being personally leading the presentation. And Minister, as you've seen what happened over the media, in the media over the past weeks and months and that, and it's a bit of a worrying factor at the moment in the economic sector, and specifically the job losses and job sector. That I was speaking to some of my constituents yesterday, you know, a big factory like Monatic. Can you switch on that mic? Thank you. A big factory like Monatic, who I am working short time at the moment, it's a worrying factor because, I mean, they've got thousands of employees and they work 3 days a week. But thank you for the work that you are doing in trying to curtail this job losses and the short time issues and that, and so that companies that are in distress can really look upon. So, Minister, with that, we want to give the floor over to you.
Well, Chairman, let me start by thanking you, the committee, particularly the good wishes for Ramadan. Shukran. And good morning to all members of the committee. I think in starting to address the question that you've raised, I would like to refer to the context that you sketched, where we are right now. But the presentation outline that I will do will briefly take the committee through some background and context. I would then hope to deal with one intervention that government has made, which is a training layoff, talk it through a little bit with you, go to investigations and collusive practices in the economy that we think still significantly holds back opportunities for employment, and then reflect briefly in progress in other areas. Now, committee members will recall that in September 2008, we had the sharpest downturn in the global economy since the Great Depression. And this was accompanied by a significant financial crisis and a loss of industrial output. The result of this has been the loss of millions of jobs across the world. The OECD, whose Secretary General visited South Africa recently, pointed to the fact that in the first quarter of this year, there are still in excess of 15 million jobs deficit in their member countries as a result of the global economic crisis. But the crisis, because we're so closely connected to the global economy, also had a significant effect on South Africa. We tipped into our first recession since the advent of democracy. The social effect of this was harsh and immediately noticeable. If we take the last six quarters, if we take the period from December 2008 through to the end of the second quarter of 2010, we've lost somewhat in excess of a million jobs, about 1.1 million jobs. Now that takes it from the highest point of our employment curve to pretty close to the lowest point that we've reached in recent times. At the same time, not only do we deal with people who are recorded as unemployed in the official statistics, but there are also large numbers of South Africans who are too discouraged to look for work, and accordingly are part of the pool of people willing and able to work but unable to find a job. And a large number of that would be young people who enter the labor market for the first time and who face now not only a labor market that is not adequately absorbed in the past, but one that has actively lost employment in recent times as a result of the global economic crisis. Over this period, from the last quarter of 2008 to the second quarter this year, we've had about 740,000 discouraged work seekers. What did we do? before this administration took office, the previous administration, under the leadership of then President Halima Motlanthe, initiated talks to organize business with the labor movement and with community organizations. And they jointly developed a framework for South Africa's response to the global economic crisis. I'm sure that committee members would be very familiar with the contents of that document. Before I turn to the document itself, very briefly, the process was as important as the product. It was something that was crafted jointly by four stakeholders who in ordinary times may have very different views about the solutions that are required, but in this case, faced with an enormous crisis, they worked together. The social dialogue allowed us to share ideas and experiences and develop some common solutions. It's the beginning of what I will talk about later, a new shared vision that we want to create in the country. And it enabled us to take some joint action, things that businesses could do, or the trade union movement could do, government could do, but also things we could do in combination. That was in February 2009. The country then went into election mode, with the election held in April. And in that period, much of the governance processes were really about preparing for the new administration. The administration came into power in May last year. And the first gift it received was the news that the country had officially gone into recession. I think a few weeks after the inauguration of the new president, it was officially announced. Technical definition of a recession is three consecutive quarters of economic contraction. During June, the president gave his State of the Nation address, and I've included in the handout his quote. We pointed to the need to work in partnership, respond to the crisis, and he took the framework for South Africa's response to the global economic crisis that was concluded previously, and he said, this will be the basis of our work, and we must minimize the impact of the downturn on the most vulnerable. In July, the newly established Economic Development Department was tasked to coordinate the implementation of the framework, and one of the instruments in the framework is a leadership task team that brings together the leadership of organized business, the trade unions, and of community organizations under my chairpersonship. We've convened 11 meetings since the matter has been put to the Economic Development Department, and honorable members will recall some of the key principles of the framework, that the burden of the economic downturn must not be placed on the poor and the vulnerable, that we need to ensure that what we do in the short term begins to lay the basis for growth and decent work in the long term, and that we need to maintain high levels of public investment as a critical driver of economic recovery. Immediately after we met with the leadership of the different constituents, we identified some key actions, things that we needed to do immediately. One of it was to address job losses through a new layoff and a new layoff arrangement and special measures for companies in distress. That's the first thing we said we needed to do. We had no instruments. South Africa, in its previous recessions, had not developed the institutional machinery to respond effectively through counter-cyclical labor market policies or other measures. We agreed that we need to address customs fraud, which has led to large numbers of job losses, and there was a particular concern that with global markets constrained, with demand slowing down in the United States and Europe, in fact, a drop in aggregate demand in those two economies, that there would be a greater focus on trade flows to southern economies like South Africa. We recognize that one of the pressures of recession is the pressure on households through rising prices when they are faced with declining incomes. And so we said the Competition Commission needed to do much more work and be a lot more focused on particularly the areas of what we call wage goods. It's areas where people are particularly vulnerable, the basic basket. We supported the promotion of local procurement, and we agreed on counter-cyclical fiscal policy. Counter-cyclical fiscal policy refers to the fact that when an economy is going down, one means of slowing the downturn or ensuring some degree of recovery is to boost public spending. So the state basically pumps liquidity into the system, sufficient for demand to catch up and for the private sector then to take over. So these were the policies that we agreed, and I mentioned earlier the maintenance of public infrastructure. So phase one was to say we don't have any of these instruments available, let's set them up. And the first thing we set up was we talked to the IDC and established a fund that is directed at companies in distress. And the IDC ring-fenced 6.1 billion rand to support such companies. These would be companies that would either lose access to credit because of the new constrained credit environment, the greater concerns about risk that the financial sector has, or it could be companies who have lost orders as a result of the crisis, but who expect the recovery once the crisis has passed. And that was our first action, excuse me, and the first achievement out of the framework. The second one was we began a process. We sat business and labor down in a few sectors. Sectors that had been identified in the framework as sectors in distress. They include clothing, the auto sector, capital equipment and metal fabrication. And we asked them to work with government to develop proposals for their sector. And some of these, and I'll refer to them again, were subsequently announced in the budget earlier this year. The third one is we decided to set up a training layoff scheme. It would provide temporary relief to workers who otherwise were faced with retrenchment, where a company, instead of retrenching its workforce, would retain them on its books, place them on a training layoff, work with a CETA to provide the training itself, and government through this public fund would pay half the wages of workers. The CETA would cover the cost of training, the providers, the premises, and so on. And at the end of a given period of training, hopefully the company would have recovered and the workers would be reabsorbed in the company. So it's the beginning of exploring an innovative alternative to retrenchment. That was what the idea was about. We approached the Unemployment Insurance Fund and the National Skills Fund and managed to secure 2.4 billion rand in total from them and a further half a billion rand from CETAs that were all ring-fenced as money that can finance the take-up of the training layoff scheme. On vulnerable sectors, I have a slide from the framework for the information of the committee, which I won't go through. The second phase was then to implement, to say, okay, we're now building the new instruments, and that took us most of last year, and can we now get it to work? So starting with the IDC fund, the IDC set up the fund, developed the rules, invited applications from companies in distress, and to date it's now approved funding for approximately 50 companies, saving or creating approximately 14,000, or call it approximately 15,000 jobs. The fund is operated across a range of sectors. They include metals, chemicals, mining, clothing and textiles, tourism, catering, agriculture, forestry, sawmilling, automotive and auto parts, and auto accessories. The total approved to date is just short of 1.8 billion rand, with an average cost per job saved or created of about 120,000 rand. And that's a key figure we keep an eye on, to try to encourage the IDC to ensure that the resources are spread where it could have potentially the highest employment impact. There are now applications from a further 14 distressed companies that the IDC is considering, amounting to a total bid request of 1.3 billion rand, and these would be considered in due course. I have included in the handout and on the slide projected here the distribution of the funding by province and the jobs impact. You will see a particularly strong jobs impact in Mpumalanga and Northwest, with fairly significant gains also in KwaZulu-Natal, Gauteng, Eastern Cape, and Western Cape. One of the things that we wish to take up with the IDC and with the local business communities is why the take-up rate in Free State and Limpopo is significantly lower than the others. And that's an area that we can now focus on. We've got a breakdown by sector, and you see the distribution there across the different sectors of the economy. Aside from the IDC intervention, which was the first of a number of interventions to address the concerns of companies in the sectors that were identified, we've developed, and it was announced by Minister Rob Davies earlier this year, a package for the auto sector. A sector package is being developed in capital equipment, transport equipment, and metal fabrication that will go beyond the generic ones. So we've got the generic ones, but we now also want to link this to what we're doing in IPEP. So we're seeing some opportunities to customize the support that is given and ensure that they feed into the programs of the DTI set out in IPEP. A number of the sectors in distress in the framework agreement were also included in IPAP 2, which was announced in February. There's ongoing work, for example, on fleet procurement now. This agreement in principle by a number of state-owned enterprises that they will seek to specify through the tenders a new arrangement. I'm sure members of the committee are aware of this, but just to briefly recap, over the last number of years, we went for transactional tenders where a SOE who needed a particular component or set of goods would specify that in respect of its immediate needs. Once those were supplied, its new needs would be the subject of a new and separate tender, and so it would go on. Now, for private sector companies who have to commit capital, there's uncertainty about the extent of the procurement that they can rely on. So we developed the concept of fleet procurement, where a state-owned enterprise would work out its requirements over a long time horizon, let's say over the next 5 years or even more. It would then set out one tender with its short, medium, and long-term requirements. in such a tender, it would then be able to specify what degree of local procurement it requires. And it means then that companies, even those who don't have the local capacity immediately or tender, can then make commitments that, say, in phase two or phase three of the tender, they would meet the local procurement commitments. And in this way, we avoid the fact that in the middle of a very, very significant infrastructure spend program, we may well deindustrialize. So we avoid that danger by giving companies this opportunity. A number of studies have been done that have been shared with the IDC and within government regarding the constraints companies face and what more we can and should do, and some of this are the subject of discussions inside of government relating to budgets. One small example of what we've done, ITAC recommended the inclusion of one class of vehicle dumper trucks into the MIDP in December last year when we saw that there was a challenge in that sector. Clothing and textiles, the challenge we found here was how do we deal both with the short-term problems of an industry but begin to change the fundamentals of its competitiveness. So government has announced a clothing and textile competitiveness program. The program has a competitiveness improvement element and a production incentive program. To date, proposals to the value of 61 million rand have been approved to assist 47 companies. And this program is managed by the IDC. A number of further applications have been received and are being processed. One further intervention to support sectors in distress has been to deal with the problem of customs fraud. In the framework itself, we committed as government that we would, commencing with one sector, begin to explore focused crackdowns on illegal imports. And we selected the sector that has potentially the largest problem, that's the clothing one. And an additional 20 million rand was allocated to focus on illegal imports. The focus has resulted, as honorable members would have seen through periodic press reports, a number of raids against companies that are suspected of importing illegally, and the confiscation of goods. For example, 750 tons of clothing items were confiscated in the second half of 2009. And more recently, in February, for example, raids were conducted on 21 warehouses and 30 shops in Gauteng, as well as on the premises of agents. So these are just anecdotal examples of the new focus on reducing this this challenge of illegal imports. Trade remedies. There were some commitments made in the trade in the framework agreement to trade remedies. Trade remedies can go both ways. In some cases, employment can be supported by reducing tariffs, particularly where it is upstream industry, where it's component that is used by the domestic industry in the production of the final consumer good. And sometimes jobs could be saved through an adjustment, upward adjustment of tariffs, as would be the case often with finished goods. And we use the example here of ITAC's work, where it increased the bound level on 35 articles of clothing. It took them from the current level to the level that they are bound at in terms of South Africa's commitments to the World Trade Organization. And at the same time, 9 fabric duty rebate provisions for home textiles were introduced that effectively lowered the tariffs or the duties payable on those goods. And in an innovative departure from the old ways of doing things, companies who apply are now also encouraged to state what the jobs effect would be of the relief that they seek from government, with periodic reporting arrangements in place. We report, and I'll go very quickly through it, on further rebate provisions on certain fabrics used in the manufacture of clothing, and these were examples of how we're using the machinery of the state now to try to address some of the problems of industries. One issue that companies have raised repeatedly in the past is the long time it takes to address any trade relief, whether it's a request to increase or to decrease tariffs. And ITAC is obviously constrained not only by the regulations, but by the fact that it needs to ensure that its decisions can survive legal scrutiny, that if any aggrieved party takes those decisions on review, that proper processes were followed, that the necessary information was collected, and so on. But notwithstanding that, we have requested that our agencies improve their turnaround times. And ITAC has now revised its time periods for investigations from 12 to 9 months for trade remedies, and there are some further information. For vulnerable sectors, it now aims to complete its investigations within 4 months of an application being received. Support for small businesses is one area that I wish to particularly point to, and that is the commitment government made last year that we would seek to ensure expeditious payment, speedy payment of invoices submitted by small businesses to government departments. The President introduced a payment assistance hotline in September last year, and to date that has facilitated 182 million rands worth of SMME payment for the period till July 2010. Much more needs to be done in this area and in the general support for small business. The training layoff scheme that I referred to at the start, the first few points in the slide just indicates what the intention of the scheme is, and I note here that the arrangement caps the salaries that people may draw, or the allowance that people may draw from the fund, to a maximum of 6,239 rand a month. As I indicated earlier, 2.9 billion rand in total has been earmarked through the two different arrangements, the training allowances and the training costs. Where did we get to thus far? Well, the first thing that we did was we tried not to set up a new machinery. We had no existing machinery to deal with something like a training layoff. And in the old days, we would simply have attempted to set up a new commission on training layoffs or a new committee or structure. This time we've attempted to see, can we use the power of networking, use the existing institutions. And we've learned an enormous amount over the last number of months about both the strengths as well as the challenges of doing this. First thing we did was to draw on the CCMA and tool up its commissioners to say that when they deal with Section 189 applications, that is an application in the Labor Relations Act where a company wishes to retrench workers, how they could assist that company and trade union to enter into a training layoff agreement. Secondly, we held targeted workshops with a number of sectors, the motor and automotive components, the metal sector, clothing sector in Durban, in Port Elizabeth, in Cape Town, in Johannesburg, to publicize the scheme. And to date, a total of 6,083 workers were placed on training layoffs instead of being retrenched or being without work. So if you add the 6,083 workers in this category with the slightly short of 15,000 workers that I referred to earlier, you get a total of just about 21,000 people who have been whose jobs have been saved as a result of these efforts. So it's the 14,900 and the 6,000. This graph shows over time what has happened. You see, in January and February, most of the applications were still being processed. That's the dark color in this slide. From March, the numbers started to come through, and by mid-August, most of the applications that had been received had been processed. So we're now about to embark on an attempt to identify new applicants in the scheme. I've included some information on the training layoff scheme by province, and because this is driven by business and labor, they've got to make an application jointly to access the scheme. There is opportunity now for us to increase their involvement in getting the numbers up. We also have for you some information on which sectors of the economy have participated most actively in the training layoff. Excuse me, I'm going to cough a few times in this presentation. The next slide goes to the broader issue of the policies that we followed to try to address the effects of a recession through fiscal, monetary, and public investment elements. The committee will know the steps taken by the Reserve Bank, a number of decreases in the repo rate. You would know that we've maintained on the fiscal side a broadly expansionary fiscal policy in the context of a significant slowing down of tax revenues. But I wanted to also bring to the committee's attention this graph, which shows the role of public investment, that is investment by government departments and state-owned enterprises. So the black thick line will show public investment and the thinner blue line, private investment. And you will see from the onset of the recession a decline in public sector investment, but not only the maintenance, but in fact the growth of public investment in that period. Without this level of investment, the job loss in the economy would have been significantly higher. One further area that we dealt with is collusive practices in the economy that undermine the capacity of sectors to create jobs. And I noted in my introductory comments the pressure on households in the recession. One of the big pressures, obviously, is food prices. We looked at food inflation, and we noted significant pressures last year in the CPI introduced by food inflation. And so the Competition Commission was mandated to investigate the food industry. It is now looking at 10 parts of that food supply chain, from farm to consumer. So we're looking at pretty much everything: bread, mealie meal, wheat flour, dairy, poultry, fats and oil, silos, as well as supermarkets. And associated products like tin plate that is used for the tinned foods. The investigations has yielded a number of positive results. In the next number of months, the Commission will be making public announcements, but I can indicate that the announcements made to date include an announcement last year for a settlement in a fertilizer case where the company agreed to pay a fine of 250 million rand. This year, a fine that was imposed on a company in the bread cartel of 195 million rand. in March a referral by the Commission of of a number of companies to the Competition Tribunal after an investigation in the wheat milling industry. A settlement that was announced some weeks ago the fertilizer industry that included the breaking up of some operations of one company in the fertilizer industry, what economists call divestiture, where the company agreed it was vertically integrated, that it would take one slice of its operations and largely divest it, sell it off to competitors, so that we can introduce more competition in that supply chain. And more recently, a consent agreement that the Competition Commission has entered into with another fertilizer company dealing with excessive pricing complaints. So you'll see a significant part of the work of the Commission in these ones has been at the starting point of the food supply chain, because fertilizers constitute a significant input, cost input, for farmers in certain products. And when you have uncompetitive prices, they multiply through the chain and are embedded in the final consumer cost, or the final cost that consumers pay when they buy food. So we hope now that each new section of that supply, each consecutive section of that supply chain will have similar positive results from our investigations. On local procurement, we committed to promoting local procurement in the framework, and we've done a significant amount of work, work that's brought together the Department of Trade and Industry, National Treasury, and the Economic Development Department, and we hope within the next 2 months or so to be able to conclude this work, to be able to publicly announce new arrangements involving local procurement. There are a number of other areas that I can briefly deal with, from government's commitment to infrastructure, where we're maintaining our undertakings and investing significantly. The further work of the Competition Commission are in the construction supply chain. We said if we are going to spend this amount of money in construction, in infrastructure, and private companies through collusive behavior and tender rigging impose huge costs on the fiscus, then the impact, the jobs and economic development impact is reduced. So there's a big investigation now in the construction industry that the Competition Commission is undertaking. Some of the other areas, the Minister for Public Works has made announcements on progress with the expanded public works programs and the number of jobs that have been created through that program. We made money available for the social plan and the child support grant has been extended by 1 year in January this year, as members will know. Now what I've done is I've just taken a range of different examples, because to give a comprehensive report on each element of the framework would have been a more substantial one than I would be able to do in the available time. But perhaps to go to an example, turning to the issue that the committee has asked us to speak to. Let me give an example of a company which is a large South African manufacturer. It's called Gull Equipment, and it produces a range of equipment that is used throughout the economy. Last year, the company hit a major crisis as a result of the global slowdown, and it was faced with some serious challenges. It immediately needed to cut its employment, but not only was it faced with short-term pressures, how to cut costs, but it had no lifeline from the commercial financial sector. And so this company then applied to the IDC, and I'm able to mention the name of the company because they have no difficulty with us mentioning it, and in fact they issued a press statement recently on the release of the interim results. It's a publicly listed company in which they made a very similar point. And the IDC supported this company, and in their press statement the company said, we appreciate the support received from government and the IDC loan. And they go into further detail, and they say, so far this year Bell has been able to re-employ 250 people at the Richards Bay plant, and this number will increase as demand improves further. And they provide further details of it. But I think here's an example where a company that directly employs 3,300 workers and has an extra, an additional 2,500 in the suppliers that are principally reliant on it, reaches out to a public facility and is able to find that facility available and accesses it, and now has transformed itself where it's gone from a loss-making operation to one that has returned to profit. And I give that example solely to illustrate with us how the scheme that we put up is intended to work. It's not intended to be a permanent lifeline. It's intended to support companies through the difficult period that has been created as a result of the global economic crisis, and then ensure that private sector initiative in energy returns those companies to profitability, and that sustains the jobs of the workers in the longer term. Some other areas that we've worked on, green jobs. We've held a very successful green economy summit a few months ago, which has identified a number of areas where we can work on green jobs, and we've targeted some 300,000 jobs that we think is achievable within the next 5 years with a range of appropriate supports. The IDC has made available 11.7 billion rand as a contribution to green industrialization, to really grabbing this opportunity that is so significant for the future. I have got a few other bits of information in the slide. Where to now? Well, what the social partnership on the framework agreement has pointed business and labor to is the importance of cooperating to address these challenges. And we've now agreed with them that we would be taking the work government is doing on the growth path in due course and discussing it with them, really to see what kind of economy do we envisage we are able to create that has much larger labor absorption, that can in fact provide the fundamental driver to bring that million people back to work and begin to address the challenges of the millions that have been unemployed or too discouraged to seek work. So we recognize that an intervention in the middle of a crisis can only do so much. You've got to get your fundamental drivers of jobs and growth aligned to the reality of high levels of unemployment. And that means, among others, that we've got to be able to increase the labor absorption capacity of the economy, that we have to grab the green economy opportunities that are there. China right now has 1.1 million workers in the green economy, and it's increasing the size of its workforce in the green economy by at least 100,000 per year. And there is an enormous potential for South Africa, but it requires focus. And the third thing that we agreed we needed to do is to draw a much stronger link between knowledge, innovation, science on the one hand, and the challenges of jobs and growth on the other hand. We have an excellent scientific infrastructure, councils, universities, a large R&D program in the country. But those are not always as focused on the challenges of jobs and growth as they can be. And that to us now is an important challenge. So, honorable members, I've attempted to cover, I hope, a sufficient spread of examples of the framework for the committee to see that there is an attempt to deal with jobs, but also to deal with the issue of food prices and to deal with the circumstances of families that have no income through measures like the child support grant that was extended. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister, for the in-depth briefing. Honourable members, we now open the floor for questions. I see Honourable Mguni, Honourable Sinclair, Mr. Mohans, Honourable Lees, Honourable Gamede. Is that all right? Honourable Mguni?
Thank you, Chair. I think the way the bailout package has been welcomed in the industry and by the workforce at large, because a number of jobs have been saved. However, Chairperson, in my assessment, or when I listened to the minister and I read through the, when he said the internet, it seems it's those bigger businesses or bigger industries that are actually able to make it in the mainstream economy that have been mostly helped by the, or have been helped through this bailout package. If you go through into the internet on this, under this bailout, there are a couple of comments that small businesses, SMMEs, they found it actually the IDC page uncompetitive because the summer charge prime plus 2, prime plus 1, whereas commercial banks are giving them a better rate or a competitive rate than the IDC. My question is, why then the IDC be, why can't it be competitive in such a way that SMMEs that are supposed to be helped by IDC, they intend to go to commercial banks? My second question is on relation to slide number 12 on the Free State and Limpopo slow take-up, as the minister has already said. Has the department tried to find out why is such a low take-up, specifically in the Free State, because I'm from the Free State. as far as I know, there's a three-year, or there's been a moratorium for the past 3 years for the Free State Development Corporation, that they cannot give out loans or they cannot help any SMME in the Free State. Has the minister tried to find out, or is the department aware of such a moratorium, with the result that small businesses that could have been helped actually can't get any help from anywhere? And thirdly is on this trainee layoff. The minister says that there's a low take-up on the, or the take-up by the industry is still a bit low on skills. My question is, are we, is the training on relevant skills? Because our economic development throughout has been consumption-driven. We want that to increase productivity. Now, are we retraining those people for the relevant skills that will actually take our economy forward, other than being concentrated on the consumption side of it? What about the demand side of it, of issues? It might not be your territory, but it also links to the 30-day period. I found that I've been approached by two SMEs to date that they've rendered services to the municipality, the local authority, but it's now 60 days they've not been paid. With the result that the workforce is no longer going to work, the project has been stopped because municipalities can't pay or local authorities can't pay. Has the department tried to have an overall view or a scope so that even local authorities, they adhere to the 30-day deadline, because we find that most of the SMMEs that are creating jobs, that are absorbing a lot of unemployment, are actually done on local authorities, with a small, you know, backyard industries. And that's so far, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Ngoni. Honorable Sinclair. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I just want to remind the Minister that I'm from that province that does not have the economic crisis, the Northern Cape. If I look at your statistics here and so, I see there's only 8 provinces that's applicable in terms of that. Now, I don't know if it's by design or by default, but the point that I want to make, Minister, is that you know the Northern Cape, you know the provinces, the people are struggling and people are poor, and the mines are laying off people and the farmers are struggling, all those things. And it's a lifelong battle to keep the Northern Cape on the map, also in terms of the IDC, greater framework in terms of funding and support and all those types of things. So maybe I'm a bit naughty when I say it, but I hope that the Minister and his initiatives will also look at that. Which brings me to the issue about the bigger picture in terms of the world economy. What is the Minister's anticipation about the apparent W that we're going into, specifically regarding the nervousness about the European markets and so on? Certainly is going to have an impact in terms of the way that the Department and the Economic Development themselves present or adhere to these specific issues. Because it seems that the IDC is fulfilling a worthful role in this whole process, but I think the IDC must further build on the mandate that it had initially, and that is also to create new jobs, not just to keep the current ones going. Now, the 6.1 billion that's been put aside, what is the basic criteria that companies must adhere to qualify for these type of support and loans? And which links me to the issue that my colleague has raised in terms of the SMME issue. Now, it's fine to save the big companies, but what about the small ones, the ones that really need those support? The third issue is the one which is not directly linked to the Minister's portfolio, but which I think, if used wisely and properly, can really assist in terms of addressing the issue about jobs in South Africa. And this is the EPWP2 program, the Extended Public Work Program 2. Now, Minister Jeff Deutsch doesn't appreciate it when you tell him, but currently the EPWP is not creating decent jobs. You know, and I must really tell you that I hate it when I drive wherever in the province and you see people standing next to the road with orange overalls and they're cutting the grass. That's not decent jobs, man. We can do so much better. We can even uplift those people in their own communities by adding value by, for instance, doing maintenance in schools or hospitals or those types of things. So if I can use this platform to plead with you to wherever you've got the input to say, let's be a bit more innovative in terms of the way that we create jobs. The last issue, Chairperson, is a very specific issue, and it's issue from the Northern Cape, and I want to raise it as an example to say that in terms of the partnerships that we're all speaking about, it's necessary that the various spheres of government must also take responsibility for their own environment, if I can call it like that. Let me give you the example. There's a town in the middle of the Karoo called Victoria West. It's part of the Ubuntu municipality. The only economic activity in town, except the co-op and maybe here and there small business, is an abattoir. A private investor comes in, he invests almost 12 million rand to upgrade the facility.
He goes into agreements with the local municipality in terms of energy supply, in terms of transferring the property to him at a certain stage. But then the problem comes when the municipal officials must honor their commitment. They don't do it. The year down the line, 12 million private investment is in jeopardy, but more than that, 70 to 80 jobs can be and will be lost if government from another sphere does not intervene in a very urgent manner. So the point that I want to make is we must look collectively at the various spheres and the responsibility also at the lowest level, which is the local municipality. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Secretary. Honourable Lees.
Mr. Chairman, I'm inclined to be as brief as I can. I have the full page here, but having listened to the two speakers, honourable members, go on. As I must cut my... Mr. Minister, the question of the auto package, is that over and above the existing help that the motor industry gets, the MIDP and so on? And if it is, you talk about Bell equipment and the success there because they've returned to profit and the assistance then falls away. How long are we going to keep the motor industry going by virtue of state assistance? When will it become sustainable in its own right? In terms of the clampdown on so-called illegal imports, are these imports illegal on the basis of brands or on tariffs, or what kind of illegality is involved here? I know that I've seen press releases about brand infringement and so on. There's a huge amount that you're putting into wherever you put them, into fires or whatever. But what impact does that have on the cost of similar products, the availability of low-priced products for the people who actually are suffering from a lower income? Because what we're doing is we're protecting local industry to have a higher pricing structure. It has a negative impact on the people who have to do the or the consumer. You talk about vulnerable sectors on page 10, but you don't tell us what those vulnerable sectors are. I'm curious that you talk about a salary cap in terms of the assistance given, but 55 jobs cost us $2 million. What is the cap and how did that happen? I think your comment on page 15 about the competition successes being positive actually should be negative, because this kind of anti-competitive behavior is not positive, it's negative. But I'm making a point simply that I get your point, but it's not a positive thing to find all these anti-competitive behaviors. It's actually negative because they shouldn't be happening in the first place. It's really quite disturbing that there is so much happening. But I get the point. I'm not... Yeah, it's just the way we put it. The Green Job Summit... I'm just reading my notes here. Yeah, the IDC 11.7 that you talk about, how is it going to be spent? What is it? What kind of goals do we have for? The discouraged workforce is indeed a huge problem, and you quite rightly, I believe, talk about it being largely the school leaver group. Why then is the wage subsidy that was announced in February still not being implemented? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Lee, Honourable Gamere.
Thanks, Chair. Honourable Minister, I've rewritten my question. I'm
try to classify them. Others, I'm thinking I should postpone for them. Postpone them and give you on the 24th or 20th of September. Others will take them here. One of them is your last comment. You might comment if you want or not about the type of economy that you want to pursue as a department. At the end, what would we want to achieve? This is Department of Economic Development, so there is an economy that we must pursue in this country. So, if you will, but it's not an answer, I'll find some time, someone who has no time to discuss this thing. Another comment will be on the issue of the decent jobs that was raised by Honorable Sinclair. But my plea to the department is to do some campaigns on this issue. Because there is a United Nations description of decent work. So it's not only painting or cutting grass. I think the department is quite the right department responsible to educate communities about decent work. Concerns housing, it concerns quite a number of things. So that's the request I'm putting to the department. The possibility of breakdown of sectors per province. You have given us the provinces that 8 firms, for instance, in KwaZulu-Natal. After those 8, I would appreciate to get the sectors. Not in this meeting, we can send them, so that I know in KwaZulu-Natal. Because I've heard whether this is true or correct. We also have another company besides Bell in Richards Bay, the Tata Steel KZN. I've heard that there are challenges. I'm not sure whether they have approached the IDC. I just wanted to empower myself first before I could advance on this matter. But I heard that on this company there are serious challenges. The other question is, you know, IDC seems to be now highly involved. Quite a number of things, you know, bailouts and everything. While at the same time, the IDC has got to look at the bottom of the office page at the end of the day. Is this going to be possible? You know, if it's moving in this direction so much that it's assisting companies, I'm sure it won't put pressure on its payments. Will its balance sheet still be as good as it is? this community comes from a study tour in China. No, the committee. The committee is a committee. If there's a member who didn't go, it's unfortunate. But the committee comes from China. And what we learned there was that most of the tax revenue is also raised from the SMMEs. And they seem to be, you know, leading the economy of the country, contributing quite a lot. How far are we towards moving towards that direction? The other question is, on the list of sectors that were identified, whatever, auto, tourism and so on, is that list exhausted or it was just an example? Do we have somewhere, housing, logistics? I've seen some companies being closed. I'm not sure whether they were aware of this assistance. And maybe this committee would be sent, all the members, the committee. Where could we assist also members, these companies, where from each and every province, how should we advise them? The last one would be, I've had a look at statistics these days and some research. I'm not sure whether it's for the 20th once more, but it says the number of people that are poor or unemployed has decreased. But at the same time, the number of rich people has increased. But surprisingly, the gap between the poor and the rich has also increased. How do we deal with that?
Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Kamere. Honorable Faminga.
Thank you, Mr. Chief. Mr. Minister, thank you for coming today. It's not every day that we have a minister here talking to us. So it's very much appreciated. Thank you. And that doesn't take away from the fact that you are all here. We're happy to have you and we're lucky to have you. Thank you. Decent jobs. I have to agree with Honorable Sinclair that maintenance is not a culture in South Africa. And somebody must create that culture. And I don't know how we're going to do it because it's a serious, serious problem. And maybe we must start bringing the maintenance culture into our local municipalities, because that's where it bites the hardest. In private business, it's being used, but, and I don't know if it's your affair, Mr. Minister, but maybe you can consider that. And then when it comes to decent jobs, the health, I see there's nothing done in the health sector. And that sector is in dire need of decent jobs and bringing back the culture of health and sort of honor in the economy. I've made ears in my pages here, so I've got to go from ear to ear. On page 9, you talk about the confiscated clothing that you've taken, the tons and tons. And I think Honorable Lees touched on it, saying, where did it go? Can that not be made available to NGOs? I know that you can't really, but at the moment, there are so many people in distress that maybe we can make, not an exception, but find a way in which the stuff that has to be destroyed can be used for the poor. And I'm not talking about luxury items, I'm talking about essential items like clothing. You don't need sunglasses, but you definitely need clothing. Then, on page 14, you were talking about cartels and collusions and so on, and you know, they, especially when you speak to the agricultural sector, there's still a big gap between the producer prices and the consumer prices. And at that level of the agricultural sector, they are almost in a situation where they are producing at below, they're being paid at below cost, which is, I don't know how you address that or whether it's not your department, but to me that is economic well-being in our rural areas. Then the fines that you make, that's being applied to the industry for contravening the collusion or whatever, price fixing, where is that money going? Where is it applied? It might not come to your department, but please help me out on this one. And just tell me where it's going, because I would not like it to, that you would say it's evil money, like the abalone money, and that it can't be used. Money has got to be used where it's most needed, so we can't say no, just apply it properly. And then on the last page, government committed to 1 million solar water geysers. I've heard there's a firm in East London and that's new and up and running, and then suddenly I heard there's a collapse again. Are you aware of it? Is it part of your department? Can you help me out on that one, please? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Van Lingen, Honorable Chen.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. Excuse me if I look so sad to you, because I just had a bad cold. Yeah. But first of all, I want to say thank you so much, you know, for this a really a very encouraging presentation to us. At least now we know something's happening. and something's going, and obviously there's always a room to get better on that. My question is, obviously we now hear from the minister saying to boost the economic, we need to encourage this public spending. But I'm getting a little bit confused here. There is also a need in our country here, you know, to encourage the culture of saving. So how should we keep the balance in between of that then? Thank you so much.
Okay. One more. Okay.
Chairman, a quick one. I did make a note of it. There's been a reduction on rebates on fabric imports, but an increase in rebates on product clothes. I think that's the way I read it. Now, what has happened in the textile industry in certainly my part of the world, I mean, frame textile, we've lost 4,500 jobs in one factory in Ladysmith, and you're probably well aware of it. And so reducing rebates on textiles surely has a negative impact in that primary sector of the textile industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Members, Honourable Minister.
Well, Chairperson, through you, can I thank the Honourable Members for their questions. I've counted 28 questions. I'm going to try to see where I can group them. But I think they're very useful because they help us to illustrate some areas that we were not able to put in the slides, and there's some very good and thoughtful comments, I think, that are wrapped up in the questions that I will pick. Let me start with the Honourable Nguni's comments. When we've designed the packages for support, one of the challenges we realized is that our institutions, our public institutions, are not always attuned to the priorities and the policy challenges of government. As if, in practice, what has happened is separate fiefdoms have sprung up. When you set up an independent company with an independent board that has a political relationship with government, you have to constantly reinforce what is that mandate. You've seen it in the media in a number of different areas where public entities operate completely indifferent to the policy mandate of the government that they are supposed to be part of. Our challenge was, let's begin to introduce a package and then keep on refining. So we did this with the IDC. And as we get the reports back from the IDC, you will see on the faces of Economic Development Department members the scars of constant battle going back and saying to the IDC, now why don't we have more in the Western Cape or KZN, whatever the matter may be? Why don't we have more jobs per million rand that is made available? Why don't we have more small businesses included in it? Why don't we have more of the sectors that have been recognized as sectors in distress? And it's in that process that we begin to change both the mindset of public institutions, but also get to better alignment between the mandate that the electorate gives and what public institutions must deliver. So the points you've made about the cost of the IDC package is one of the sharper discussions that we are having with the IDC. From the IDC side, and I'm going to come back to a question that one of the other Honourable Members asked, they face this constraint. Since the 1950s, governments put no new money into the IDC. Unlike in Brazil you have, let me contrast two models, the IDC and an institution, a bank called BNDES, which is a Portuguese acronym. In the case of the IDC, government made a once-off endowment, I'm using dramatic language because actually there were a few further payments, and these all ended in the 50s. The IDC then uses that to build up a portfolio of investments that is A, relatively safe, and B, has a high return. But no economy industrializes if it sticks only to safe established business. Part of the responsibility of a public institution like that is to make some degree of venture capital available. People come up with new ideas, some of these ideas survive and they become the next big thing and they create huge numbers of jobs, some of these ideas fall away. But that increases your risk profile. New projects very often don't have the high returns that an organization like the IDC may want. So, that's model one. Model two, the Brazilian one. In Brazil, BNDES has a regular annual infusion of capital from the state. There's a deduction made from the payroll tax that goes into somewhere between our UIF and our compensation fund, it appears. And the state takes a small portion of that and recapitalizes BNDES. BNDES then fairly aggressively invests in the Brazilian manufacturing sector and in some associated supply lines. They provide a cost of capital that is significantly below market. So the discount to the market rate is very, very high. Contrast the two outcomes. In the case of South Africa, relatively pedestrian performance in manufacturing. In the case of Brazil, a significant growth of the Brazilian manufacturing capacity to the point where we now buy buses and lifts and so on from Brazil. If you look into some of the lifts that we use around here, you'll see manufactured in Brazil. Some of the buses for the rapid bus transport system we'll be driving in will be courtesy of Brazil. If only we could, we tried importing the soccer skills through the coaches. But we need to change that. So there's a short-term pressure on the IDC to bring the cost of lending down, but there's a longer-term challenge to think how do we release more resources to the IDC. So what have we done? One of the things we've looked at is the current lending by the IDC from international and domestic capital markets. Economists talk about your debt to equity ratio. How much do you borrow to finance your operations compared to how much do you own? In the case of the IDC, it is trying to find a better way of putting it, but it's not very highly leveraged. Only about its loan book, where it borrows money on markets, is equivalent to about 5% of its balance sheet. Now, you can increase that significantly using absolutely prudent criteria. Prudent criteria are when you don't take unnecessary risks, you don't over-leverage, you don't take more debt that you can comfortably service. So the IDC has now been encouraged to increase the money that it takes up from international capital markets to be able to make available to local business. Then it comes to the cost of capital. Now, I've only recently had the IDC reporting to me. And in the board meetings I've had now with the IDC board, I've had a detailed discussion with him about the issue of mandate. Does government ultimately value the IDC for its financial return or for its industrialization return? Now, it's more complex than it appears, because on the one hand, you need the discipline of profit. You need to go in there saying, we want this to be commercially viable. We don't want to subsidize endlessly something that can't get to its own feet. On the other hand, our return, the IDC is a bank, our measure of it, the shareholders, is not the same measure that the shareholders of Standard Bank would apply. In the case of Standard Bank, they would simply see, what is the return? Is it the highest possible return? For us, possible financial return. For us, it will be the employment return, the small business return, the green economy return. So the IDC is now engaging, it's a super tanker, it's a massive organization. It's now engaging in a serious review of its policies to take account that we need to have a much stronger industrialization and employment outcome of that institution. It's got an asset base of 70 billion rand. And it needs to be able to deploy that prudently, but in a very focused way to have these outcomes. So I've taken the broader issue, Honorable Mguni, you've rightly pointed to one element of it, but it's a broader issue. So whilst the IDC does excellent work, I mean, we can't deny that it's an institution that does make a difference. I gave you the example of Bell. We say, and we put to that management, the challenge to significantly lift the bar of performance, to have much better industrial and employment outcomes. And I have focused on this issue of the cost of the distressed sector package. By the way, the argument is that companies who access that package often have, they're unable to access generally the facility in the ordinary commercial financial market, and they often come with high risk. And normally what financiers do all over the world is there's a relationship between the return you want and the risk you take on. So they say, well, the companies are high-risk companies, therefore we have to charge more. We point to them that we want them to maintain some eye on the risk profile, but if the IDC package ultimately is uncompetitive even against the commercial banks, and more than one company have come to us to say, we finally walked away from an IDC package and secured the package elsewhere, then there's something wrong in how the IDC calculates risk. Now, two banks, you go to Nedbank and Standard Bank, and you put your information to them, they may come with different risk assessments. That's the nature of each bank's internal systems. Where they get it right, they make money for their shareholders. Where they get it wrong, they make losses. So there's a big story around the IDC that I've raised also with the portfolio committee. And one of the things that we now are doing, we're working with all three of the development finance institutions that reports the economic development, the IDC, Kula, who does small business financing, and SUMOF, who does microfinance. We're beginning to sift through their books to see what is the real cost of providing the service to the ultimate consumer. How much, if you take 100,000 Rand from SUMOF or Kula or the IDC, what's the admin and other costs? And are they efficient? And can they begin to share services? Do we need separate SUMOF offices in each province, separate Kula offices and separate IDC offices? Do we need separate CFOs for all of them? Do we need separate premises and buildings? So in looking at this, we can begin to bring down the cost that those institutions incur internally, which means we can bring down the cost that they charge their clients. So that's really where our work is going now. I hope by next year that we will be able to report substantially to Parliament on how successful we've been. These are early days. I would prefer not to have it publicized, but we are setting up. We haven't yet finalized all the details of it, what we call a dashboard of performance indicators. Something that swiftly and clearly indicates for each of these institutions, are they succeeding, are they failing, in a set of development goals that we set. So a long answer for an important issue, which is the cost that the IDC charges for its services. And my staff will smile because they'll know it's an area that I have raised quite sharply with the DFIs. The second question, Honorable Nguni, that you asked is similar to the one that Honorable Sinclair asked, and that is the big disparities in the slide that we have up there between, on the one hand, a free state that has very little resources allocated to it, worse still, the Northern Cape, that I suspect is not on that list because there's not a single company that receives support through this particular fund of the IDC. Now, I think there's a few things we can do. The one is, we saw when we did the road shows to PE, Durban, Cape Town, Johannesburg, that it had a positive effect in making companies aware of the facilities. We need to strengthen that, and perhaps I could take up the challenge and see whether we could now add another few road shows in some of the other provinces that are underserviced in this facility. But the real challenge is to get, in the case of the IDC facility, business, and in the case of the training layoff, both business and labor, to apply. Because this is driven, it's an application-driven process. It's not government going out to a private business and telling it, look, we see you are in distress, would you like help? We publicize that the facility is available, and then we leave it to the private sector to apply. So I would certainly suggest that one of the things that I could report in future to the select committee is whether a road show, and we could select perhaps three of the provinces, the ones that have had the weakest outcomes, Limpopo, Free State, and Northern Cape, and see whether that makes a difference. But also if you know of companies in your constituency that are undergoing these difficulties, I would be very happy to make available to you as parliamentarians, as members of the NCOP, details of the IDC facility. It's a public facility, and encourage those companies to apply and provide some information to me on what the reaction is of the IDC. I'll institute some steps, my side, to keep an eye on those three. The question, Honorable Nguni, that you asked on what kind of skills are generated in the training layoff. Well, we took a decision very early on that government would not prescribe the skills, that we would leave it largely to the enterprise that has people on the layoff together with a CETA to design the skills. This was the logic. And we want to make sure that it's skills that will be used by the company the minute it reabsorbs workers. So there's not as much value in expanding skills that people will not be able to use. So we've attempted to link it much more closely to the workplace. When you look at the sectors that have largely taken the training layoff, you will see that most of them are in what we call the real economy. In other words, in the productive economy, they're not principally in what would be seen as your consumption-led new sectors, your shopping malls and so on. They're pretty much very strongly focused in manufacturing, and the information is in the slide. There is, of course, a wider question, which I hope when we finalize our work on the growth path, we can come back both to the portfolio committee and the select committee, and there may well be, Chairperson, if I may respectfully suggest, some value in a joint session of the two committees on the growth path, where we deal with this issue, the challenges in the past of an economy that was fueled by a consumption-driven, unlike China, which has been very production-driven growth path. We've had a very consumption-driven growth path, which means at a particular point, unless it's supplemented, it runs out of steam. It's run out of steam very dramatically now in the face of the global economic crisis. On the 30 days and the 60 days problem at the municipality, even though it doesn't fall within the department, I would be happy if you were able to share that with us and we could see what inquiries we can make. But let me take the broader issue that perhaps you're raising and the Honorable Sinclair has raised in his example of Victoria West. And that is to make sure that we don't only get our story right nationally, but also provincially and locally. That all three spheres have to work in coordination. So what we've done is we've invited the MECs and Salga and the mayors of the metros to now be part of the MinMAC discussion on the growth path. And it's the first time we've included local government. So we're not getting it perfectly right yet. We had a number of the mayors, not all of them. We had Salga, but the strengthening Salga's capacity from a central level to be able to interact with all the municipalities is an area that we would want to talk through and work through with them. So, yes, I think I would take your point about payment. I would take the Honorable Sinclair's point about jeopardizing private investment through non-adherence to commitments that were given. So those are fair points. Honorable Sinclair, I've covered two of your questions, but I would make the point that for the Northern Cape, the one big opportunity we see is in solar energy. And so we have asked the IDC to work on solar energy in a significant way. And you may know that there is a range of other work being done within government to explore the potential for solar energy in the Northern Cape. The Northern Cape must not be missing from that list. When I looked last year, and I haven't looked this year at the breakdown, I've got the data here, but last year, the proportional loss of jobs at provincial level was highest in the Northern Cape. And for reasons that are clearly understandable, it is the province more than any of the nine that is absolutely reliant on mining and agriculture. It is a very undiversified economy. And so when the primary sector is badly affected, it disproportionately affects the Northern Cape. So our longer-term thing must be to try to find more economic diversification. If we simply do more mining and more agriculture, important as that also is, then it makes that province very, very vulnerable to the economic cycle. On the world economy and the double dip challenge, well, no one really knows. I mean, by the week, economists change their mind on the prospect of a true double dip. But what is very interesting is we have a global economy now that is unlike any other recession. In this recession, you have two poles. On the one hand, the European Union and the United States with low or no growth. The OECD projects for the rest of this decade an absolutely flat economic performance, so very little growth. The one exception to that right now is Germany, relying principally on exports to China. On the other hand, you have fast-growing, rapidly industrializing parts of the global economy, China, India. China's now got roughly two growth rates seen before the global economic crisis, as if there's been no crisis. And it's off the back of significant investment in their domestic economy and in domestic consumption. So now Chinese consumers are consuming more, and that's the principal driver of the new growth. Historically, they've relied very greatly on export growth. India is pumping enormous sums of money in modernizing the infrastructure. They're really ensuring that the Indian economy is going to be able to take off rapidly when the global economy recovers. But in the short term, as a result of that infrastructure spend, they've got buoyant growth rates, very, very buoyant growth rates. On the 6.1 billion rand, I agree completely with you that the IDC should be creating new jobs. It's not a portfolio manager. And I've reminded the board of the IDC, it's not a portfolio manager. If government wanted a portfolio manager, it can appoint a portfolio manager at small cost from the private sector, load government assets there, and let them invest it. It's an industrializing agency, and that means we're testing it by whether it creates new jobs. And as it creates new jobs through ventures that it owns and controls, we see at some point it must spin them off, sell them to the private sector, get into something new, pull those up, sell them to the private sector, so that it constantly also replenishes its own resources through that. I mean, I make the point, which I'm sure every member of the committee knows, that South Africa's most important industrial company is Sasol. It's the largest, it's got the most important technology, it's got world-class technology, it's a big player in downstream industry, and it was principally supported by the IDC until it was divested. So there is that role it must play to find new opportunities, to find the Sasols of the future in the period ahead. On the 6.1 billion rand in the criteria to qualify, there are a number of rules that the IDC has, and I can happily circulate those rules to the Honourable Sinclair. But I guess your question is a policy question, not the detail.
Mm.
And at policy level, I guess what the IDC is looking for, qualifying criteria, is number one, a company must be demonstrably in distress. So it requires the financials basically to be able to trace. Secondly, that distress must not come as a result of poor management, but it must come from external factors that are connected in some or other way to the global economic crisis. So that could be many. It could be a loss of a big order as a result of one of your customers going bankrupt, or your United States customer just not buying at the moment. Or it could be, and I draw attention to this, that your bank is not prepared to lend you money on the same terms as before, because banks have tightened their risk criteria. So it could be the connection to the global economic crisis can be one of a number of issues. And thirdly, that the company must have a viable business plan. It must be able to show that as a result of this IDC support, it can stabilize from a downswing, it can stabilize, and it can eventually return back to viability. And finally, it must be able to show that there is a employment gain for the society in intervening, in taking what is really public funds and making it available to a private entity. So those are the broad cost-cutting policy criteria. And then we can arrange to send to you in the course of today or tomorrow the rules that are applicable to the fund. On the EPWP program, let me say that I think we all recognize that what we're doing is we're creating a facility that, number one, provides very short-term jobs, and number two, does it at a rate of pay that is modest. And we are now looking at how can we make some changes to the EPWP family of programs. And I hope when that is completed that I can answer a little bit more concretely to the challenge of how to get more out of the EPWP. So we share that concern that we need to achieve more with it as a program. That is probably a longer-term program. It's been designed as if it's a very short-term intervention you can do for a few months. But the truth is, our employment challenge is so enormous that we probably should be thinking of the EPWP as a medium to long-term program. It in itself can be improved, as honorable members, you and others, have suggested. But it's not ultimately the key means of creating decent employment. That has to be through getting your private sector economy to perform a lot better. It's got to be changes in manufacturing, in mining, in services, and so on. A public employment program supplements that. It's a short-term bridge for the individual. It may be a long-term program of government, but it's a short-term bridge for a person to make them more employable, to give them some short-term income. So while I accept the opportunity to change and become more innovative, we can't achieve too much with that one program. It's got to be used in combination. And some of our ideas are now to use these programs in combination. We haven't completed the work in government, but for example, if I can answer the Honourable Lisa's question on the wage subsidy and youth employment, we're looking at a comprehensive package of proposals, because simply one means, one little mechanism that we introduce won't have the effect of significantly turning around the challenge. I mean, when we look at it, more than half the unemployed in South Africa, young people. More than three quarters of young people are without jobs. So these are, you know, enormous challenges. And all the different tools that we have available will be combined. It includes a little bit of the philosophy of public works, a little bit of the philosophy that the subsidy wants to encourage, which is how to find ways in which companies take young people on board, even if it's for a certain period, introduce them to an industrial culture, give them the opportunity to shine and show that they are adding value to that company. And the bit in the middle that I haven't mentioned is the training part. And there we're sitting with Minister Nzimande to see how can we use FET colleges a lot more effectively to give young people training and skills that are usable in the economy. And that's the key word, to make it skills and actually there's a job for that skill. I don't like an approach that rubbishes the humanities, but you know, if you do a training course on Shakespearean literature, your ability to immediately find a job is probably more limited than if you had plumbing skills. Not an argument against the humanities, but really an argument for skills to be designed to take up the opportunities in the labor market. Honourable members, I go next to the Honourable Lisa's comments. The MIDP, what we did was we've been in transition between the MIDP and the development of the APDP. So we used the period, because that happened during the onset of the recession, we used that period to sit down with companies and reach agreements that allow some of them to fast-track some of the packages that was available in return for commitments. One of the commitments that companies needed to make was to have a moratorium on retrenchment, save where there was genuinely no alternative and then there were some mechanisms in place. But let me come to the broader question on the sustainability of the auto sector. I dare say it would probably be the subject of an entire session of the committee to go properly into it. But we're faced with a range of challenges in manufacturing. And may I connect this to, Honourable Lees, to your other question on illegal imports. If left simply to market forces, if government stepped out completely, it probably means that we would lose a very large chunk of our manufacturing sector now. Why? Well, there are many factors. First, industrial policy across the world is replete with examples currently of governments supporting the industry, from countries with a free market philosophy to countries with a more national planning philosophy. Take, for example, the United States. The United States puts significant resources into the building of its aerospace sector through its military budgets. That then has two markets. It has markets in selling military aircraft across the world, which creates American jobs, but it also has civilian applications, because technology can't be boxed. So if you do, if you have some innovation in the cockpit, it also is incorporated in Boeing's designs. France is a classic example of a country that has invested significantly in a range of high-tech sectors. So that's one part of it. The second part of it is we recognize that our exchange rate is uncompetitive, and we compete often with countries who manage the exchange rates. And I need not point to the most visible example of that. And so in those circumstances, when the critical driver of your price competitiveness is outside of your control as a company, but it influences the price of goods that you sell on international markets, but also the price of goods locally. So remember, you're competing with cars that are made elsewhere in the world. Government action is about supporting that. So what we did with the MIDP was 15, 20 years ago, before the 1994 election, South Africa had a highly protected car industry, highly protected. and we had a proliferation of car models. We made just about every kind of vehicle within a particular monkey's make. So if it's BMW, we made the full range. The MIDP has been structured to reduce the number of the vehicles. And when you do that, you get all the efficiencies that come with large-scale production. The economies of scale you get. But in order to compensate companies from the for the fact that our tariff regime is still relatively high in auto sector, and they would now have to import that which they no longer make locally, we designed a export arrangement that encourages a company to make the car, sell it on the domestic market, sell it in global markets, creating jobs here, and then earn a reward that they can use to defray the cost of the tariff on imported cars. So it's not unlike what many countries do. Each one has their own package of support for its key sectors. The General Motors package was particularly noteworthy in the U.S. stimulus package as an example of a government stepping in and saying, look, we're not prepared to pay the price socially of a loss of our car-making industry. So I recognize that one has got to tread warily here. Too much support and you remove the incentive for companies to become competitive and you take the dynamism out of a company. No support at all and you just have the collapse of the industry. Now, in the longer term, as we build up the other sources of competitiveness, the skills profile of the South African population, the price of steel through the beneficiation of iron ore, and you've all been witnessing in the last week or so what has been happening on that front. As you get your other sources of competitiveness right, the need to intervene so directly is reduced. So I think it's the pragmatism, it's avoiding the two extremes of constant and permanent state support, whatever the circumstances, or alternatively just disappearing completely from the market. I didn't know who went to China, but I'm sure they would have plenty of really interesting stories about Chinese industrial support, the Chinese state's support for its industry. And the results are out there for everybody to see. It's had a dramatic effect on China's growth, its employment, and its share of global industrial production. On illegal imports, the other part of the question was, what is described both? It's both where you have a hold of intellectual property, let's say Adidas, and fake goods are made abroad, as well as companies who import goods by under-declaring their value or their volume. And so it's basically a kind of tax fraud that is perpetrated. What about the price of clothing? I think for all the manufactured sectors, the one choice we have is do we want the manufacturing sector or not? And there's a significant set of multipliers. You know, when you close a textile mall, as I think Honorable Lisa may have had some experience in fact, it's not just the loss of spinners and weavers and finishers and their management. Inside that community, there are people who are supplying services to the company. It's called the economic multiplier. And the economic multiplier for manufacturing is very high. In the case of clothing often provides jobs to the poorest people in South Africa. It's the lowest paid in manufacturing. You'll find it in the poorest parts of the country. The big sectors of clothing manufacturing would include places like Newcastle, Ladysmith, Isithebe, Botshabelo. These are bitterly poor areas. So if we want people to come into manufacturing, into an industrial economy, often clothing and parts of electronics are really your only ways of doing it effectively. We hope we can get more knowledge-based economies in future, but at the moment, these play quite, even today, even with all the job losses, they still a significant employer of labor and of very, very poor people. So as government, our role is to just keep on balancing these things. Poor people have a jobs interest and they have a consumption interest. They want wages and they want lower prices. And it's just finding that balance, which no ideology can give you. There's no one answer. You've got to work through them case by case and see in this, these circumstances, does the actions that is contemplated make sense. The point, Honorable Lee, that you made about the 55 jobs, 2 million, this is the big discussion with the IDC. This is what I take as the key issue of oversight, to begin to say to them, are you, when you make these decisions, are you aware of the employment consequences? Are you trying to increase the employment per million rand of support that you give? So it's exactly what we're focusing on. On the Green Economy Summit, well, we've just made the announcement now. The IDC is now beginning to put together a business plan. But we said to the IDC that we'll need a lot more than 11.7 billion rand. So this has to be done strongly in partnership with the private sector and with other public entities. So, for example, when Eskom and the agencies that are responsible for other areas of infrastructure do their procurement, to the extent that some of their procurement will involve the green economy, how do they coordinate with the IDC? So you create a demand for the product, you create the financing for the product, and you need then the entrepreneurial energy to bring the thing together. So there's more work going on like that now. I thank Chairperson, you and the members for your indulgence. We'll try to run a bit quicker through the remaining questions. On Honorable Gamedi's questions, the big question on the type of economy, I think perhaps when the growth path work is shared with the select committee, then I can give a more detailed answer, because it would go to the question of how to place jobs, decent work and development at the center of the economy. That's really what it is, but to really unpack that a little bit will take a bit more time, so I would be grateful if I could have an opportunity perhaps in future, after the growth path is completed, to deal with that question. We would certainly need to undertake work on decent work, and using the UN and ILO definitions of decent work, it's of course much broader, and the ILO has begun to use the term decent work and decent life to connect the production and the consumption side of human beings. But decent work itself refers, among others, to the quantity of jobs you can create in a particular society, so it's employment, to the conditions of that work, what is called social protection. And social protection is not just wages and working conditions, it's also whether a society has an unemployment insurance system in place, whether it has an old age pension, what is called social security. And then it's social dialogue, that you have conditions of freedom in a society where business and labor can interact, bargain collectively, and so on. And it deals with the issue of international labor standards. There are a number of conventions of the ILO that we've adopted as South Africa, ratified by this parliament. So it's a very wide-ranging definition, and perhaps the department should give consideration to the suggestion that we do a lot more advocacy work to explain what decent work entails. I'm happy separately, Honorable Gamedi, to provide you with more information on the sectors in the IDC list in KZN. I think I've answered the question on the IDC bottom line when I responded to the Honorable Nguni's earlier question. On the IDC criteria, it's open. In other words, it's not limited and confined to the sectors here. These sectors are people who have applied and succeeded. And that reminds me, Honorable Lees, in the framework itself, there is a description of sectors in distress, And in this slide, which is slide 10 in the handout, we reproduce some of the language. Because at the time when we negotiated the framework, we were not certain what would be all the sectors that would be affected. We didn't want to give a definitive closed list. So you see the language would be language like vulnerable sectors are those sectors with significant employment and labor intensity and where there are currently large planned or actual job losses. So it applies a test. Then it gives examples. It says specific sector strategies to address vulnerable sectors such as clothing, textiles and footwear, mining, the auto, capital equipment sectors will be set up. So inside that there are about five, six sectors that are defined, but again it's not a closed list. If the printing sector suddenly as a result of the crisis was to have its bottom falling out, then we would have the capacity and the freedom to bring them in. You'll see at the bottom of that also we talk about electrical and electronic sector, engineering, the building materials industry. So there are a few identified in the slide. And then finally, Honorable Gamedi, on income inequality, I think the way in which one can describe that you could have a smaller percentage of your population living in poverty and yet growing income inequality by looking at two things. The one thing is how much money does each of them get? In other words, let me put it differently. Is the growth at the top faster than the growth at the bottom? If it is much faster, then your income inequality rises in your society. The second one is that there are two measures of inequality. The one is income inequality, and the other one is the broader measure of inequality that takes into account access to housing, education, and so on. And I think the last set of detailed questions is from Honorable Van Lingen. I agree with you that maintenance is important, many job opportunities there, not just in the EPWP space, even in things like our railway lines, our power stations, there seems to be evidence that we have underinvested even in those areas in adequate maintenance, which then shorten the life, which means that you've got to commence your build program sooner. And so maintenance not only creates jobs, it makes economic sense also. And so that's an area that we've covered. Confiscated clothing, it's a complex story. It's there's been many different approaches SARS has adopted over the years with confiscated clothing. In some cases, they've auctioned it. In other cases, they've given it to charities and NGOs. In other cases, they've sent it as relief in instances where we've had a disaster elsewhere on the African continent, floods or similar natural disasters. And each of these have their advantages and disadvantages. The challenge that SARS found years ago when charities were used, is first there was a high level of fraud that began to creep in where people were registering charities to access the clothing and sell the clothing. And secondly, there was the problem that when charities were selling the clothing, even legitimate charities, they sometimes sold it on the so-called high streets to be able to generate cash, which was of more value to them. So it had all these unintended consequences, which then knocked the clothing industry, which led to the businesses and trade unions in the sector bringing all this evidence to SARS. So, you know, there's an old saying, no good deed ever goes unpunished. So, yes, but SARS, I think, and government looks continuously at different ways of how we dispose of this in a way that finds the best connection with all of our policy goals. The point about agriculture and costs of production and prices are often below cost of production, that often reflects the relative power, you know, between someone growing something and someone selling it in a supermarket. The power often is towards the end of the process. Competition policy is about opening that up, ensuring that you can have more entrants where there's a monopoly or a quasi-monopoly, that there is no collusion if more than one customer of a farmer colludes to say, let's only offer him 5 rand for his products per kilo, that is illegal in our law. But it's very difficult to prove. And so competition policy is precisely about opening all of that up. And I hope it will have the necessary effects. Where do the fines go to?
I realize I'm talking about milk at the moment. It's a typical one.
Yes. And one of our investigations was in the milk industry. And as you know, you may know, there are a couple of milk companies that we are pursuing right now. This matter, there's a broader dairy industry investigation going on. And I don't want to mention the names of the companies, but some of that has already come out in the public domain. So we as they say, we're on to them. Where do the fines go to? National Treasury, and it becomes part of government's general income, which then gets distributed via the budget speech in February. We hope to worthy causes. And then I don't know about the company in East London that is involved in solar water geysers that has closed its doors. If you would be kind enough to just separately provide staff members with details of it, I think it would be worth looking at, because this is supposed to be a growth sector as opposed to a declining sector, because there's a big market in future for this. So we could perhaps just check what the circumstances were of that. And then finally, the Honourable Chen asked a question, which is, it's a difficult one to answer quickly. Economists tend not to agree with each other on most things. But the one area where most economists agree is in a market economies go through economic cycle. And the economic cycle is very deep down. Be a recession, and if it falls even below that and it gets to a depression, then the stability of the system itself is in danger. So the argument that John Maynard Keynes raised during the Great Depression in the 1930s was that government's role when the private economy is in free fall, government's role is to stimulate spending, because firms won't spend in that period, and households won't spend adequately because they're losing their jobs, they're uncertain and insecure about the future. So then the role is for government to boost expenditure. And it does that in a number of different ways. You can do it through productive investment. You build a new power station that in any event you need, but you quickly speed up its construction to coincide with it. But he famously said, even if you pay people just to dig holes, and then you paid another group of people just to fill those holes, that's better than doing nothing. Now, of course, economic theory has advanced well beyond digging holes and filling them. So now, in this global economic crisis, governments have thought, okay, how can we stimulate the economy but do it smartly? And one area that many, many governments have identified is the green economy. Why? But everybody wants to be part of the new wave of green industrialization. And so they want to spend now to be able to achieve that. As a general rule, countries with high domestic savings perform better than countries without high domestic savings. So savings is generally a good thing, but in a period of a recession, savings can in fact be a challenge. And in fact, Japan has gone through a very difficult period where for many years its economic performance has been fairly uninspiring because Japanese consumers were so insecure, they held on to their money, they saved. And their government and the international financial institutions, the whole world was preaching to the poor Japanese worker, please buy more, please consume more, save less. And you may have noticed recently, a number of countries have been telling Germany to spend more and save less. And it led to quite a big debate between different EU member states, some blaming Germany for their own woes, saying if only you'd spend more, we would do better.
So these things are never finally resolved, and you can't apply a textbook to real circumstances. You've got to see in a given set of circumstances what you do. So I think certainly in our case, if we look at the trajectory over the last number of years, our concern is there hasn't been enough savings, and the expenditure that there has been very consumption-driven and also conspicuous consumption-driven. The latest cell phone, the latest gadgets, smartest cars. When you go in countries that are growing fast, you'll often see a lot less bling than you'll see in our case. And all of that really saps the capacity of the economy to grow. And it's really the point, I think, that Honorable Nguni was making reference to earlier when he asked me about the skills. Is it for an economy that is productively driven, or is it an economy that's largely buoyed by consumption? And in this morning's business day, there was an article that appeared in the Financial Times that I want to just end off with no doubt everybody's relief, Chairperson. But one well-known columnist was trying to explain one of the faulty logics that sometimes apply in economics. and he said, you know, if you look at health spending accounts for about 10% of GDP. So it's a very big part. One out of every 10 rand that our economy generates is spent in the health sector. So you could argue that disease is good for economies. More diseases people have, the higher the spending on health, and therefore the higher the GDP. But it's a fallacy. It's a false argument. Because it's not a measure of improving the productive capacity of the society. It consumes resources in dealing with the problems of illness and disease and so on. So sometimes when an activity grows in the economy and it inflates our GDP figures, it doesn't make that activity necessarily the most desirable. And so as an economy, if you build this massive number of shopping malls, and you've got the most modern shopping mall culture in the world, much better than you'd find in countries that we often enviously look at. It does come up, it helps to boost your GDP, because that's the way in which the GDP is calculated, but it may not create sustainable wealth for the economy. So those are discussions. I've got an economic advisory panel that we've asked them to begin to think through these questions. President Sarkozy asked Joseph Stiglitz to chair a commission just to look at how do you measure, he didn't call it this, but I would call it economic development, because GDP growth is not in itself a measure of human welfare. You can grow at 6%, but that is not necessarily an indication that your welfare, your human welfare is increasing. It's not an argument against growth. Growth is very, very important, fundamental to us achieving our goals. But where you find your growth, how many jobs that growth creates, that's the story of South Africa's growth path. And on that note, Chairperson, back to you.
Thank you very much, Minister, for that growth note. And I hope that this committee will grow as well.
The minister talked about digging holes and filling them in. We tell the committee that my father started work at the age of 13 in the Great Depression, digging holes. I don't know if anyone else came along and filled them behind him.
So you say that the minister is correct in saying that we should do that. Well, minister and department, honourable members, thank you very much. I think that has come to the end of the briefing by the department. Minister, on behalf of the committee, we want to thank you
the DG and the staff of the committee for your attendance and for briefing the committee. If there is any outstanding matters or questions, I would advise the committee members to write, to put that in writing to the department, and so that we can then follow it up. And the Honorable Gamera has made an appointment with you for the 21st or the 24th of September. So that's a whole 4 days that the two of you will have that appointment to talk about the KZN issues. But on behalf of the committee, I want to say thank you very much, Minister, DG, and the staff of the department for briefing the committee, and we hope that in future we will have much more briefings with the Department of Economic Development. We know that as a committee we have neglected the department. Last time it was the other way around. This time it's the committee that has neglected the department. But in future we will definitely have much more engagement on our economic issues with the department, with the minister. Thank you very much, Minister, and the department. Yes, if there is, we're going to carry on with our program, Minister. I'm not sure whether you want to listen to that, or, but you are excused if you want to be excused. Okay. Well, then, please, we say do that. Honorable members, we will carry on with the second part of our program. We've got, two sets of minutes before us, and our third term program. Where's my other set? If the honorable members can take their seats, the meeting is not adjourned. Honorable Van Lingen, the meeting is not adjourned. Honorable Nguni, you can engage the DG at the later stage. The meeting is not adjourned yet. Members, we've got the two sets of minutes in front of us. We need to adopt that, and our program, committee third term program, I put the minutes on the 25th of May before the committee. Of the 25th of May, placed before the committee. I've just picked up one issue there on page one. Since there were no apologies, but I don't see the Honorable Van Lingen's name either on present or on absent or on apologies. Was she present at that meeting? Or was she in Brazil by then? Now, were you present? Are you sure? Can't check all my face now.
It's so strange that I'm late or broken.
Okay, we're coming to the other one. Let's just finish this one. Yeah. Okay, the secretary can check the attendance register and then just make the necessary corrections. Is that fine? All right. Page one. Page two.
You must,
but the secretary will check it and make the necessary corrections. Honorable Gamera.
I just want to find out if that might not be the reason that Honorable von Langen stayed behind, not go to China, because he doesn't attend the meetings here. Okay, all right, that's not part of the discussion. Can I get a mover and a proposer? Honorable, thank you, Honorable Mbuni, and Honorable Chen and Honorable Gamere's support. Thank you very much. Have you got more minutes? Is that the only one? Oh, the 1st of June. Huh? Oh, someone took my copy here. Someone took my copy. 1st of June. again, Secretary will check if Honorable Van Dingen was...
Over a very sensitive issue, because the safety zone by the International Anatomic Association is 16 kilometers, and Arriva and the European so-called standard, they want to sign increment 800 meters and send it to local government or South African government, and that is why I asked the question. So we should put in and ask that the NNR put on record that the public would be protected, that the international anatomic regulations or standards to which South Africa is a signatory will be applied in South Africa. Because that was what the issue was all about.
Okay.
Can I help you with it?
All right. Page 5. Okay. Can I move for adoption with that? Honorable Kamere, can you move? Second it, sir? Thank you very much, honorable members. That's the minutes. honorable members, now there are certain problems in front of us. The 17th of August, that's today, that's been done. 24th of August, we've got a briefing by NERSA on the renewable energy feeding tariff, and then also briefing the afternoon by the IDC on funding for the green industries. I think we should take the IBC scope further, and not just on the funding from what we've heard from the minister, and not just on the green industries or the green economy, but we should take it further. And then on the 31st of August, we've got the briefing by Alex Kaur on issues raised by the communities during the oversight visit to the Northern Cape. There was a lot of issues that the communities have raised at the community meeting and Alex Kaur. Now, the CEO of Alex Kaur is overseas on the 24th. I think she's accompanying the president to China, but she'll be back by the 31st. So, we will then call Alex Kaur to come and do that briefing for us. Because remember, there were still outstanding issues which the acting mine manager could not have answered for us at Alex Kaur that day, when we were there. So, and then also we will then switch over to a joint meeting, the Trade and International Relations, to consider and adopt the Study 2 report to China in some minutes. Now, the report will be handed out to members next week to go through it and to read it, to consider it, to adopt it on the 31st of August. Honorable coming in. So then adopt the report on that.
Member of the DA Gunda.
Tell me about it.
We are going for provincial week on the 6th to the 10th of September. Everybody will be in the provinces then. And then we come back on the 14th. We will be briefed by the Department of Energy on the rollout framework for solar water and heating geysers, specifically in the rural areas. And what has the department arranged, or what is the agreement between the department and DISCOM for the rollout of that? And how far are they in terms of the 1 million rollout, which was announced by the minister in a budget speech in the NCOP? And then from the 23rd to the 8th of October, we've got a constituency period. But before we go to constituency period, we hope that we will have the foster program ready for your input and also for consideration. Other members, are there any inputs or any, because the foster program, I think we will include your suggestion, Honorable Dean, that has written us a letter to suggest that we do some oversight visits in KZN. So we will definitely go to KZN and to Limpopo and to do our oversight in terms of mining issues. Also in KZN, we will go also in Limpopo to go in terms of mining, energy, economic development, as well as maybe the trade and international relations. Of tourism and PGI, as well as KZN. I'll engage the chairperson of the Trade and International Relations so that we can get joint oversight as a honorable family.
What about visiting the Republic? It's not going to cost any much. The Republic of St. Francis, because it can be an international trip. We want to cross the crew, but I've now asked for a while that we do an official inspection of what developments are taking place at Cape Town. And it seems serious. I thought everything was recorded, because when I wanted to correct the minutes, I was told that it's recorded.
So,
Chair, we could not record it
here
because the mic was not on.
Mr. Chair, I get this distinct impression that you do not want to take this committee to statement, and I beg you, please, to take this committee to statement, and we can do the other side too to see what development has taken place. Because in the portfolio committee, it was clearly spelled out that statement is not necessarily the preferred site. However, the evidence is there. I want you to see it so that you can see with your own eyes what's happening.
Remember, now we've recorded you, but I also think that it would be advisable also to put it in writing, as some of the other members have done. I don't think it will be. That's not so bad, so specifically not for you, to put it in writing for us. But we have got that on record.
Sorry, may I just ask you, how long will it take you to make a decision on this?
Well, it won't take long. We will have to include it into our program. So, a program which you will adopt, which you must adopt, so before the end. Yeah, before the end of September. I mean, we can put it on the program maybe for next time. For next time. We can see maybe on Facebook we can go to KZM or something, but we can put it on the program for next time. It's not possible, Honorable Cunningham, to do it straight away. Or to do it in this time. You see, our perception to see it already. Taking us, we've got a week, the provincial region was not in this, but we have just had like a power continuous in provincial region, 60 to 10. We've drawn up our program and we have to cut a lot of other things also out of the program. So, and also the constitution period from the 23rd to the 8th. Is it the 23rd? Isn't it the 20th? Oh, it's from the 20th. Yeah. Constituency period is from the 20th. That's from the 20th of the 8th of October. So, with your permission, Honorable Van Lingen, or with your agreeing to it, we'll put it on the program for next time. Based on that time.
You give me your word. Thank you.
Honorable Gamera moves to the adoption of the lease.
No, why did you go
to that? No. Honorable Lee moves for the second item. Members, for that, the meeting can sit there. Oh, sorry. There is an invitation for the ladies. You want to talk? Okay. Wait. Just listen to the secretary, please.
Thanks, the Minister of Energy, the Minister of Mineral Resources, has invited the three ladies from our committee to submit a conference in Sandy. It's about the discussions online on women mining on the 20th. About the notice, I have to find out from the department if they are going to pay for it.
All right.
And I would like to know if our members will be attending so that I can inform
them. Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the invitation. I think I should also respond. I already have something really big on an Eastern Cape and I won't be able to make it.
I hope you're not planning on that much. That's my mic was not on, so that's off the record, not recorded. Honourable members, Honourable Kamele has just informed us that for your town, Honourable member, tomorrow's meeting has been postponed. The department is not in a position now to give a concrete a report on what it was to brief us. One, and two is that it still has to brief the cabinet subcommittee on the website. So rather than calling them to brief us on something else that orders in this committee, we thought to wait for them in the appropriate time, so there's no briefing tomorrow. Also, I asked Mr. Delaney to forward his invitation that he got from International Relations. Honorable Noyes is that when he was in Brazil, Honorable Van Dingen, they discussed about these agreements. So there is a workshop on Friday that has been arranged. And we're invited to as a member to attend that workshop. I'm not sure whether you do have copies of those invitations, but I'll ask on listen to them if you send those invitations.
Thank you, Honorable. So Honorable Family, we must have been committed to our work our knowledge that you're saying today in Brazil.